KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
Los Angeles became a tinderbox this weekend as demonstrators and police clashed over a series of federal immigration raids that saw more than 100 immigrants detained.
We'll have the latest from the city.
For Monday, June 9th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. We'll talk to a former acting vice chief of the National Guard on President Trump's use of the National Guard this weekend.
Also coming up this hour, how some of Wall Street's top CEOs are managing the uncertainty created by President Trump's chaotic tariffs.
I really thought we were looking at 4 years of just tremendous growth and tremendous American economic vitality.
And hundreds of scientists have issued a document criticizing research cuts to the NIH.
This is an extinction-level event for biomedical research, and it's just wrong not to say something.
Those stories and more coming up after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. As protests continue against ICE arrests in Los Angeles tonight, the Trump administration now says it is mobilizing 700 Marines to the city. That's after the deployment of 2,000 National Guard troops and the just-announced deployment of 2,000 more. California's attorney general says the president has, quote, trampled on the state's sovereignty and filed a lawsuit. City streets were quieter today, though at the moment there's still tensions at another rally in the city's downtown. Multiple immigration raids in the Fashion District in downtown L.A. Friday led to the arrest of more than 40 workers, more than a dozen from one company. NPR's Vanessa Romo reports on a rally held by their family members.
At least a dozen of the 14 people taken away by ICE and FBI officers are in some way related or can trace their connections back to the same Zapotec town in Veracruz, Mexico. Sarai Ortiz says her dad, 55-year-old Jose Ortiz, has worked at Ambiance Apparel for 18 years as a floor manager. She says her father has been sharing Know Your Rights cards with fellow employees, encouraging them to be informed, not afraid. But now he's been gone for more than 2 days, and she still has no idea how or where he is. She tried the county jail, but they tell her he's not in the system. Vanessa Romo, NPR News.
The Trump administration's travel ban blocking or restricting entry from more than a dozen mainly African and Middle Eastern countries has gone into effect. Ban comes as tensions escalate over the administration's crackdown on illegal immigration. Here's NPR's Jasmine Garz.
It is a long list. 12 countries fully banned, including Haiti, Afghanistan, Iran, Yemen, Libya, Sudan, and Somalia. And citizens from 7 other countries will be subjected to partial bans, including Cuba, Sierra Leone, and Venezuela. Now, these are countries that the administration has deemed a threat to national security or public safety. And this ban builds on the ban from Trump's first term, which was upheld by the Supreme Court.
NPR's Jasmine Garz. A federal judge has temporarily blocked the Trump administration's Department of Government Efficiency team from accessing federal personnel records. NPR's Shannon Bond reports.
The court ruled the Federal Office of Personnel Management broke privacy law and its own cybersecurity practices when it allowed DOGE staffers to access the files of millions of current and former federal workers. The scope of the injunction is still being determined by the court. But Judge Denise Coate ordered DOGE staff to destroy all copies of personal information related to the union members who brought the lawsuit. The case will likely head to the Supreme Court, which has recently reversed other lower court rulings curtailing DOGE. Last week, the High Court granted DOGE access to sensitive data held by the Social Security Administration. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
A mixed close on Wall Street. The Dow was down a point. The Nasdaq rose 61 points. This is NPR. Entertainment giant Warner Brothers says it is splitting off its cable operations from its streaming service, creating two independent companies. The move comes as the number of people who are foregoing cable for streaming continues to grow. HBO, HBO Max, and Warner Brothers TV and movies would become part of the streaming division. CNN and TNT Sports, among others, would be part of the cable company. American bullfrogs have expanded well past their native range in the eastern part of the U.S., and that's causing some trouble for local species. NPR's Ari Daniel has the story.
The American bullfrog will eat whatever fits inside its giant froggy mouth, including California's northwestern pond turtle.
We sometimes refer to them as little cookies because they're so cute.
Sydney Woodruff, a PhD candidate at UC Davis, says in much of Yosemite National Park, the turtles have disappeared, except for a couple water bodies where there are still adults. Woodruff and her colleagues removed some 16,000 bullfrogs from these locations. The result?
Our first couple of small pond turtle hatchlings and juveniles swimming out in the environment.
So once the bullfrogs were removed, younger turtles could survive, suggesting targeted bullfrog eradication could help restore certain ecosystems. Ari Daniel, NPR News.
Iconic musician Sly Stone, head of the group Sly and the Family Stone, has died. A dynamic showman who helped alter popular music in the 60s and 70s. Died at his home surrounded by family, the backbone of Sly and the Family Stone. He appeared at Woodstock, had such hits as I Want to Take You Higher, Stand, and Family Affair. Sly Stone was 82 years old. I'm Jack Speer, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. In Los Angeles, protests continue over federal immigration raids. The city had a tumultuous weekend with some incidents of vandalism and violence, as well as peaceful protests. President Trump called in the National Guard despite opposition from Governor Gavin Newsom. California's Attorney General said today that they have sued the Trump administration over that action. And NPR has confirmed that the federal government is mobilizing 700 Marines to respond in a, quote, support role. Another rally started late morning in downtown L.A., and Aaron Schrank from LAist News is there covering it. Hey, Aaron.
Hey there.
So, Aaron, I know that there was a bit of unrest last night, some reports of Waymo cars set on fire, as well as some vandalism. Tell us what it's like there today.
It is a calmer, more peaceful scene here today at one large protest in downtown Los Angeles, where at least 1,000 labor union members and supporters gathered at a park where they called for the release of labor leader David Huerta, the president of the Service Employees International Union of California. He was arrested in an immigration raid on Friday in LA's Garment District during one of several confrontations between U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents and protesters. He was arraigned after the protest started today. He pleaded not guilty, according to his attorney. He was released this afternoon on a $50,000 bond and was speaking with supporters on the street. The people rallying were also calling for ICE to stay out of LA's immigrant communities. Local elected leaders are also here, including LA County Supervisor Janet Hahn.
I'm very upset. I feel like the federal government has invaded Los Angeles County, and we don't want them here.
Aaron, help us if you can remember how we got to this point.
Yeah, so immigration raids began in Los Angeles on Friday afternoon, which sparked some small protests in downtown L.A. Then on Saturday, we saw protests begin in the city of Paramount, south of L.A., after rumors of a possible immigration raid there. According to the L.A. Times, protesters threw things at federal officials and tried to block an ICE bus. That night, we saw protests erupt at a federal detention center in downtown L.A. where immigrant detainees are held. Then President Donald Trump announced Saturday evening he was sending in National Guard troops against the wishes of Governor Gavin Newsom. Hundreds of National Guardsmen arrived there on Sunday morning, and more protesters showed up, and there were clashes throughout the day yesterday. We don't know exactly how many people have been arrested in these immigration raids so far, but as of Saturday, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security said that that number was 118 in Los Angeles.
Now, the rally where you are is being hosted by David Huerta's labor union. Can you tell us a bit more about them and what their role has been in all of this?
Yes, the Service Employees International Union, California, is the state's largest public sector union. Huerta was arrested for allegedly conspiring to interfere with federal officers conducting an immigration raid. A complaint filed by the federal prosecutor in Los Angeles alleges that were to block vehicles from entering or exiting a property, that they had a warrant to search. That's a felony charge that carries a maximum sentence of 6 years in prison. The union says Huerta was exercising his First Amendment right to observe and document law enforcement activity. California politicians, including Governor Gavin Newsom, have denounced the arrest. Today's protest is evidence of just how intertwined the labor movement and the immigrants' rights movements are here in Los Angeles.
Aaron, last thing, what are you watching for next?
Well, we are certainly watching for more ICE activity around the city when we hear of it, and obviously a further military presence here with the latest news from the feds. But even with that uncertainty, folks at this event and others around the city say they will keep showing up to peacefully protest.
That's Aaron Schrank from LAist News. Aaron, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And elsewhere in the show today, we've got our interview with California Governor Gavin Newsom. Stay tuned for that.
If you're having a hard time figuring out what's going on with the U.S. economy, you're not alone. Wall Street's top CEOs are trying to manage all the uncertainty created by President Trump's chaotic tariffs and other economic policies. They're also dealing with some strong emotions. NPR financial correspondent Maria Aspen reports.
Wall Street is more and more worried about America's superpower status. Take JPMorgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon, who runs the country's largest bank. He recently said he's worried about the power of the U.S. dollar and how other governments have historically relied on it.
I always get asked this question, are we going to be the reserve currency? And no. You know, if we are not the preeminent military and the preeminent economy in 40 years, we will not be the reserve currency.
So his bottom line?
We have to get our act together and we have to do it very quickly.
Dimon is in good company. The people who run the country's banks wield a vast amount of power over our financial system. They're usually first to see what's happening in our economy. And these top executives have spent most of this spring going through the five stages of tariffs grief, starting with denial.
They are not thinking so much about tariffs. They are thinking about deregulation. They are thinking about lower taxes.
That was Conference Board senior economist Stephanie Guichard speaking in March. CEO confidence had just soared to a three-year high. But fast forward to late last month, and CEO confidence has plummeted in its worst drop in half a century. Now Wall Street seems to have moved on to anger and depression.
I really thought we were looking at 4 years of just tremendous growth and tremendous American economic vitality.
That's Ken Griffin, the billionaire investor and Republican megadonor, speaking at a Forbes conference last week. His feelings reflect a lot of the emotional roller coaster that Wall Street and, well, all of us are on when it comes to figuring out what's going to happen to the U.S. economy. But big company CEOs tend to have more power than most of us, and now they're calling for more bargaining, especially with China. At the recent Reagan National Economic Forum, Dimon warned the United States against continuing to escalate its trade war with one of its largest trading partners.
I would engage with China. You know, I just got back from China last week. They're not scared, folks.
Meanwhile, some of Wall Street's top economists are warning that we all might need to practice acceptance of an economic downturn, that is. Goldman Sachs chief economist Jan Hatzius is currently predicting that the U.S. has a 35% chance of falling into a recession in the next year. That's come down from April, after Trump unveiled most of his tariffs. But as Hatzius said at a recent Goldman conference,
35 is still a sizable number. And I think a lot of it is around the fact that the president loves tariffs.
It's not just the tariffs, of course. The surging national deficit, the president's proposed budget, and recent economic data have also worried investors, consumers, small businesses, and big business leaders. So if there's a silver lining to all of this tariffs grief, it's that Wall Street CEOs seem increasingly willing to speak out about it. Here's Katie Koch, chief executive of the bond trading giant TCW, at a recent conference.
There's this narrative that we need to embark on these policies because somehow we were losing.
She pointed out that Americans have reaped a lot of benefits from our country's global economic superpower status.
We've done a lot of winning already, and we do have a lot to lose.
And if that happens, Wall Street and the rest of the country will be starting the grieving process all over again. Maria Aspen, NPR News.
Sly Stone has died. He was the eccentric frontman, singer, songwriter, and producer of his family group, Sly and the Family Stone. Stone was a key figure in the creation of funk. He died at the age of 82. Brandon Gates has our remembrance.
Before Sly Stone became a pioneer of funk, he, like many music greats, started off in the church. Born Sylvester Stewart, the second of five children in Texas, he moved to California with his family. By age eight, the musical prodigy was releasing gospel music with his siblings, part of his first group, the Stewart Four.
He took me by my hand. I joined the Christian band.
He became known as Sly in grade school when a friend misspelled Sylvester. At age 11, Sly Stone was proficient in keyboards, guitar, bass, and drums. By high school, he had founded an interracial band making records in Los Angeles. Sly Stone kept on breaking barriers when he co-founded Sly and the Family Stone in the mid-1960s. In Sly Stone's band, the women, notably, were not just vocalists, but also played instruments, a rarity for the era. The group started charting hits in rock, soul, and R&B. This one spent 4 weeks as the top song in America in 1969. Sly and the Family Stone's sound was a dazzling fusion of psychedelic rock, soul, jazz, gospel, and Latin. The band's consequential performance at Woodstock was documented in the film of the concert.
Well, we knew something magical was happening.
That's Sly's sister, Rose Stone, in a 2007 interview with NPR.
And the sun started to come up, and all of a sudden, all we could see was just a sea of people. It's like an apex of our group.
In the 1970s, Sly Stone's music got gloomier and more cynical after the assassinations of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and President John F. Kennedy, along with elevated racial tensions and the Vietnam War. After producing some of the most euphoric and politically charged music that defined a generation, Sly and the Family Stone dissolved, in part because of Stone's drug abuse. He rarely showed up for shows and years later was arrested for cocaine possession. By the 1980s, Stone had slipped into seclusion with a few sporadic reappearances. But Sly Stone was a visionary. His music is now woven into the fabric of American joy. For NPR News, I'm Brandon Gates.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Today is the fourth day of demonstrations in Los Angeles after Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents conducted raids there on Friday. Since then, there have been mostly peaceful demonstrations daily, though there have been some clashes between law enforcement and protesters in and around the city. President Trump has called the protesters insurrectionists, and he sent in the National Guard to support ICE agents and ensure law and order, a move Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass told our co-host Scott Detrow is, quote, an intentional effort to sow chaos. Now, as plans for protests spread across the country, the state of California is suing the Trump administration over the National Guard deployment, and California Governor Gavin Newsom joins us now. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Let's start there with the lawsuit. You've decided to sue the Trump administration. Explain why, on what grounds?
Well, it's an illegal act. It's immoral. It's also unconstitutional. And the mobilization order that was sent to the Guard has a statute that requires it shall be issued through governors of the states. And I want to remind people listening, this impacts every state in America, not just the state of California. Obviously, for anyone's been listening and watching, that mobilization order was not done with communication to our office. It was not approved by my office, quite the contrary. In fact, Trump's own executive order directing the DOD said to coordinate under Section 12406, and I forget the technicality, but it's an important one, and that section explicitly states the same, that the order must go through the governor of the state.
NPR has earlier this evening confirmed that a full Marine battalion, around 700 Marines, has been mobilized for Los Angeles in a, quote, support role. Your reaction?
Well, he's sowing more division, more chaos. He's inciting just the same, and more fear, more anxiety, a more likelihood that people are going to be hurt. We're on the other side of the red line. This has little precedent in modern American history. He also just ordered an additional 2,000 state National Guard to be federalized, now over 4,000. The irony of that, by the way, shouldn't be lost on anybody. He's only been able to find operational demand for a little over 300 state National Guard. He has 1,700 that haven't been tasked. And here he is trying to assign tasks to an additional 2,000 and threatening the Insurrection Act by mobilizing the military to come into a U.S. city and creating conditions that many would be perceived as a threat.
This seems to have started over ICE agents attempting to carry out detentions if they face threats by people who are trying to impede their work. Governor, would you instruct state or local law enforcement to assist them?
Well, we do not impede upon federal authority to enforce federal law with federal resources, period, full stop. That's the state of California. And so my state of mind is they have a lawful right with warrants to move in that direction. If they are attacked or if their lives are at risk, everybody has a responsibility, we all do, to protect the peace. But what I do not support is this random acts that are occurring all over LA County. I've been meeting with leaders and activists that said in 30 plus years, this simply has no precedent, and we're just day four.
Now, Tom Homan, who is President Trump's so-called border czar, has threatened arrest for anyone who gets in ICE's way. And in another interview, you essentially told him to bring it on. Today, President Trump told reporters that he would do it if he were Tom, that he would arrest you. Are you prepared to be arrested?
Yeah. It just shows the theater, the theater of the absurd. That's all this is weakness masquerading as strength. These tough guys, and I said, look, it's day three of threatening arrests, and I thought in my life I would never hear the words of the President of the United States of America. These are things you see in authoritarian regimes and dictatorships. And I never thought those words would be uttered by a president against a political opponent who happens to be governor, because that governor disagrees with his unlawful orders. Look, I, after 3 days of hearing this, you push back. But look, I have no problem. If he wants to arrest me, let's dispense with the threats. If he wants to do it, let's just get it done. But what I'm sick of and what needs to end today is arresting children and creating a state of arrest all across our state, this chill where people aren't even going to graduations, hundreds of graduations in LA County. Kids are scared to go to graduation. Families are unwilling to gather publicly. They're scared to walk the streets. Stop that. You need someone's head. You need to be the tough guy. You need to show how strong you are. Fine, take me out. But have these kids have some decency and have the backs of these children.
We've got a little more than a minute left. We mentioned that there are plans for more protests across this country outside of your state of California. Governor, any advice for other state and local leaders who may find themselves up against some of the same challenges that you and your state are facing today?
Well, this is there's so many ways we've seen this movie before January 6th. He stoked the anxiety, the fear. He helped create the conditions. And then he sat back as he's the music man or so. And he quite literally put people's lives at risk. The overwhelming nature of saying you care about law enforcement, and he's the guy who literally pardoned the people that attacked law enforcement and attacked the core constructs of our democracy. Well, he's doing that again. This is not about immigration. This is not about the state of California. This is about a state of our democracy. This is about the cornerstones of what this country was founded on, co-equal branches of government and popular sovereignty, the rule of law. And so my warning to every governor, regardless of your political stripe, is this is a preview of things to come. And I pray for only one thing, and that's peace, peaceful protests. And to the agitators, to the outliers, to those that are coming in to sow even more chaos than Donald Trump himself, that's what he wants. And I also pray they are held to account. You can't smash cars. You cannot create conditions that make peaceful protesting more difficult and play into Donald Trump's hand. And so if there's any counsel and advice, it's to be very clear about the rules of that kind of engagement. But the bottom line is Donald Trump has created this mess, and it will be governors across this country who will have to clean it up.
We will have to leave it there. That's Governor Gavin Newsom of California. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
A Colorado neighborhood that lost homes in a wildfire rebuilt in ways that are more fire resistant.
It's about being prepared for disaster in general and making your community safer.
Learn about home hardening as part of Climate Solutions Week, plus the latest on protests of immigration raids in the Los Angeles area. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. The French Open came to a close yesterday. Carlos Alcaraz won the final in dramatic style.
Sinner and Alcaraz. They are the current. They are the future. They are incredible.
A look back at the French Open after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. California is suing the Trump administration over its deployment of National Guard troops to confront immigration protesters here in Los Angeles. State Attorney General Rob Bonta seeking a restraining order to halt the action after days of protest and clashes over a series of immigration raids in L.A.
President Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth unlawfully federalized 2,000 California National Guard troops for 60 days with no indication as to when they intend to stand down.
President Trump is also making good on a threat to deploy hundreds of active duty Marines from nearby 29 Palms in the desert to the streets of Los Angeles. They will join 300 National Guard members already deployed, possibly more coming. California has strong laws protecting the civil rights of migrants, including those who do not have legal status. High home prices and mortgage rates are driving a historic shift in the housing market. NPR's Amy Held tells us affordability remains a huge issue, but it's becoming more of a buyer's market.
For the first time in more than a decade, sellers outnumber buyers by a third, or a half million people, according to a survey by online real estate company Redfin. Just 2 years ago, buyers outnumbered sellers. The shift means negotiating power for buyers could be increasing and home prices decreasing modestly, down 1% by the end of the year, Redfin projects. Expense is driving the change. Median home prices have topped $430,000. And mortgage rates near 7% are more than twice what they were during the pandemic. A separate survey by Bank of America finds, faced with high prices, young buyers especially are compromising. About a quarter say they had to buy with a sibling. Amy Held, NPR News.
The democratic island of Taiwan is making a controversial push to secure itself against threats from pro-China residents there. NPR's Emily Fang tells us that's ignited a debate over national security and civil liberties.
This week, Taiwan began vetting more public employees, inquiring if they had disclosed holding an identification card for China. Taiwan's powerful neighbor has repeatedly threatened to invade the island. This push from Taiwan began earlier this year. There's been some high-profile arrests of political aides who investigators say were spies for China. And Taiwanese authorities say they've already found two public employees who had a Chinese ID they did not disclose. Earlier this month, Taiwan revoked the citizenship of a Taiwanese man who they said obtained residency in China. But some of the measures to curb Chinese influence have divided people in Taiwan. Most controversially, the government deported a Chinese-born blogger who'd lived in Taiwan because she'd broadcasted that she supported China controlling Taiwan. Emily Fang, NPR News.
The U.S. and China are holding trade talks in London for the first time in months following last week's phone call between President Trump and his Chinese counterpart. Both countries have agreed to temporarily lower the triple-digit tariffs, which has slowed much of the commerce between the world's biggest economies. China says exports to the U.S. dropped 35% last month. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Subaru and its retailers, partnering with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society this June to give blankets and messages of hope to patients facing cancer. Learn more at Subaru.com/care. From the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone, and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. National Guard units are like a state's own emergency response team, often there to assist during tornadoes, wildfires, and floods. They rescue people and clear debris. They also deploy abroad to fight in wars. Now, President Trump has enlisted them to help in his deportation campaign. Over the weekend, he bypassed California Governor Gavin Newsom to federalize the National Guard in California to protect federal immigration agents carrying out deportation operations in Los Angeles. We have retired Major General Randy Manner on the line to talk about that. He was the acting vice chief of the National Guard Bureau during the Obama administration. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much for having me.
I just want to start by asking you, when you saw President Trump federalizing the National Guard in this manner, what was your reaction? What do you think the implications of this are?
There's at least two primary unintended consequences for the average American, no matter whether you live in a blue county or a red county, is he absolutely is trying to intimidate the average peaceful demonstrator, because most of those demonstrators are actually peaceful. That's number one, suppressing freedom of speech. The second one that we have to be very concerned about is this is also suppressing states' rights. A duly elected governor is elected by the people to guide the state, protect the people. And unfortunately, here we have a federal authority coming in and suppressing that governor and the people of a particular state. So those unintended consequences, it doesn't matter where you are in the political spectrum, they should absolutely alarm you, and you should be concerned about it.
The president, though, does have the right to call up the Guard. We've seen a number of presidents do this during the Civil Rights era, for example. Tell us what's different here.
There are two things. Number one is, this is a legal order. It's important to say that the president does have the authority to do this. Number two is it the right thing to do at this time? Certainly the state of California, the governor, has the law enforcement resources there, and also through various agreements, the ability to call them in from additional jurisdictions and even other states from other governors to assist him. Plus, of course, he has his own National Guard as a backup.
The National Guard unit that President Trump has called up here, as I understand it, it is an infantry unit. They are not military police. Are they the best ones suited to do this job?
It's important to note that the National Guard is not trained on a ready-to-go situation for doing civil disturbance. It requires additional training on literally sitting in the armory and working things out.
The Department of Homeland Security requested 20,000 National Guard troops last month to help with deportation operations, and a memo obtained by NPR says they would be used in, quote, night operations and rural interdiction and guard duty and riot control in detention facilities. If this plan does move ahead, what is your reaction to the Guard being used more broadly in these sorts of operations?
Number one is we have to remember that there is a cost associated with this. 20,000 guardsmen would cost somewhere between $2 to $3 billion a year in terms of the cost for pay and allowances. That is not something that is in the budget. It is something that the president will have to reallocate, and the Secretary of Defense reallocate from other programs that would obviously affect readiness or military construction. Number two is obviously, what is the impact on readiness for the entire military when we start taking large formations like this out of the existing infrastructure? So it's not just like there's 20,000 people ready to go. You have to have them ready, prepared, and then to deploy, even in the United States. So its effect will be immense on our national security.
And then separately, the memo that was obtained by my colleagues at NPR says that National Guard troops will be used in these night operations and rural interdiction. How troubling is that to you?
That's potentially extremely troubling. That implies to me that they are going to actually be on the front line of dealing with Americans in cities and rural areas under difficult circumstances, quite frankly, as if they were in at war in a foreign nation. And that is not what our National Guard is trained to do. That is not their role. And it's a very, very dangerous path we are going down. We have over a million badged and trained law enforcement officers in our country. These people are the ones that should be performing those actions, not armed military.
Retired Major General Randy Manner, former acting vice chief of the National Guard Bureau. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
The anger, frustration, and despair that have been simmering at the National Institutes of Health burst into public view today. Hundreds of federal scientists issued a document criticizing research cuts and restrictions at the Federal Health Agency. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein has more.
More than 300 scientists from every center and institute on the NIH's sprawling campus just outside Washington, D.C. in Bethesda, Maryland, signed the document called the Bethesda Declaration. The declaration decries big cuts in funding and other changes at the agency, and it calls on President Trump's NIH director, Jay Bhattacharya, to protect the NIH.
It's a horror show. We're under attack in every way, all the time. We're told we're worthless. We're told we're cheats.
Sarah Coburn has worked at the NIH's National Cancer Institute for more than 21 years. She's one of 92 NIH staffers who agreed to sign their name to the document publicly.
This is probably the most stressful period of my life. It's 1,000 cuts. They're breaking things that won't be repairable.
And Coburn and others say putting the health of the American people and the nation's stature as a global leader in biomedical research in jeopardy. Ian Morgan studies antibiotic resistance as a postdoctoral fellow at the NIH.
This is an extinction-level event for biomedical research and global public health. And it's just wrong not to say something and not to try to right this ship.
The name of the document refers to the Great Barrington Declaration, a controversial open letter Bhattacharya helped write early on in the COVID pandemic. It questioned lockdowns and other public health measures. At the time, Bhattacharya and his co-authors were dismissed by some NIH leaders as fringe scientists, but now he's running the agency. And the declaration says the administration has politicized research under Bhattacharya by halting a range of studies, including health disparities, COVID-19, immunization hesitancy, and the health impacts of climate change. The administration has also fired hundreds of scientists and other essential workers and terminated thousands of research grants and contracts worth billions, hobbling studies at the NIH and universities around the nation. The declaration calls for restoring funding and reversing destructive policies. Jeremy Berg ran one of the NIH's institutes from 2003 to 2011.
I think they're very brave to stand up for themselves and for many, many, many of their colleagues at NIH and for the entire scientific community and indeed the entire country.
In a written response, Bhattacharya, the NIH director, said the Bethesda Declaration has, quote, some fundamental misconceptions about the policy directions the NIH has taken in recent months, but adds, quote, respectful dissent in science is productive. We all want the NIH to succeed. Rob Stein, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. An Italian referendum on granting faster citizenship to immigrants has failed because of low voter turnout. And there's a story behind this low turnout. As NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports, Italy's right-wing anti-immigration government was against the referendum proposal. And rather than campaign for its supporters to vote no, it tried to boycott the democratic process.
Consideriamo l'esperienza che abbiamo svolto un'esperienza molto importante.
Maurizio Landini, the Secretary General of the trade union that helped bring about the referendum. In conceding defeat, he said union members had always known this referendum wouldn't be easy, but it was crucial to keep these issues on the table.
I problemi che noi abbiamo posto con questo referendum rimangono completamente sul tavolo.
Italians were asked to vote on whether to keep laws that liberalized the labor market and on the controversial topic of Italian citizenship. The question, whether to reduce from 10 years to 5 years the time it takes to naturalise as an Italian. Campaigners for the change in the law said this would help second-generation Italians born here to foreigners who can spend years, often long into adulthood, battling to get full citizenship rights from the only country they know as home. Coming out of a polling station in Rome's leafy green Monteverde district, Giorgia Cuomo tells me she cares deeply about these issues.
Allora, ho deciso di venire a votare perché lo sento molto vicino questo referendum.
Working in central Rome, she says, she's commuted alongside immigrants, people who've been in Italy, paying their taxes for years without representation.
Giorni vivendo questa città proprio a pieno. Ho capito tante cose, ovviamente ho fatto le mie valutazioni sull'argomento.
I've understood many realities, she says, and have come to my own decision on the argument. But in the end, Cuomo was in the minority of Italians who chose to take part in this referendum. As polls closed, only 30% of eligible voters had participated, far below the 50% required for the referendum to be upheld. One reason for this was that Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni and her right-wing government had done their best to kill the referendum.
Ho scelto di dire che vado al seggio banalmente perché sono il presidente del Consiglio dei Ministri, penso che sia giusto.
Here Meloni told reporters she would visit a polling station out of respect for the process, and she did that, but then didn't actually vote. The Speaker of the Senate and member of the right-wing Brothers of Italy party, Ignazio Della Russa, went even further, campaigning in the run-up to the referendum for party supporters to just stay home. Opposition parties accused the government of betraying a civic duty.
In un paese dove c'è una crisi democratica evidente.
And Maurizio Landini from Italy's trade union called it an example of Italy's democracy in crisis. But government leaders remained steadfast, celebrating the failure of the referendum. Economists in Italy say relaxing citizenship laws could help address the problems caused by Italy's aging society and woefully low birth rate. But Meloni's government has campaigned on reducing the number of foreign migrants in Italy and often sees Italian identity as intimately linked with blood ancestry. And so, for now, the laws remain unchanged. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Tennis fans woke up this morning with joy that the sport they love is in good hands.
It was a big two-week swing of emotions. The French Open started with a tearful farewell to the phenomenon that was Rafael Nadal, 14-time winner in Paris.
And then yesterday's men's finals.
It is a match for the archives, a moment that tennis will measure itself against itself for years to come.
Pundits like TNT's Adam Lefko believe that the era of the big three, Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal, and Novak Djokovic, has ceded ground to a new era, the new two.
Sinner and Alcaraz. They are the current, they are the future.
Italy's Yannick Sinner and Spain's Carlos Alcaraz played a 5.5-hour thriller on Sunday, the second longest Grand Slam final in men's singles history. Alcaraz, who at 22 years old already had four major titles under his belt, captured his fifth after overcoming a two-set deficit against 23-year-old Sinner.
Oh, it's over! Carlos Alcaraz reigns in Roland Garros!
Their play was so competitive that point for point at the end, Sinner earned one more than Alcaraz, 193 to 192.
Between the two of them, they have won the past six Grand Slam titles. After the match, Alcaraz anticipated a great future for his opponent.
I'm pretty sure you're going to be champion, not once, but many, many times. It's a privilege to share the court with you in every tournament.
During the women's final Saturday, 21-year-old Coco Gauff staged her own comeback, dropping the first set against reigning French Open champ Aryna Sabalenka to win the final two sets.
That's out! Coco has conquered the clay!
With that victory, Gauff became the first American to win the French Open since Serena Williams a decade ago. She also became the youngest American to win the title since Serena Williams did it back in 2002.
In her post-match speech, Gauff became emotional, recounting the last time she got to the French Open finals.
I was going through a lot of things when I lost in this final 3 years ago. I'm just happy to be here. A lot of dark thoughts, and just the fact that I stayed to it just means a lot.
For those of you who are feeling real FOMO after this weekend, well, you have 2 weeks of Wimbledon starting June 30th.
And with such young superstars, years of great tennis ahead.
Flamenco is a music and dance form strongly associated with Spain, but here in the United States, it's also linked with one state in particular, New Mexico. And as John Burnett reports, the epicenter of flamenco in New Mexico is Albuquerque.
Later this month, Albuquerque is hosting a world-famous flamenco festival. The University of New Mexico offers the only dance degrees with an emphasis in flamenco. And the National Institute of Flamenco is home to a conservatory and a world-class repertory dance company.
Uno, dos, Mario Hill.
An instructor is showing a studio full of kids the classic percussive footwork. The popularity of flamenco has exploded in the last four decades. You can find it from Tokyo to Israel to Toronto throughout Latin America, in Miami, New York, and San Francisco. What's different about flamenco in Nuevo Mexico is that it's homegrown, which makes sense. New Mexico traces its Hispanic identity to the arrival of Spanish settlers 400 plus years ago.
There's other people who want to do and replicate flamenco exactly the way it's been done in Spain. Here in New Mexico, it's got to sound like us.
Vicente Griego is a celebrated flamenco singer from northern New Mexico.
But what makes us really special here and what keeps us honest is that we have our own history. We've had our own celebration and liberation.
That's Griego singing the deep song of flamenco with Hijastros, the American Flamenco Repertory Company. It's part of the National Institute of Flamenco, founded 43 years ago by Eva Encinas, the Grand Dame of Flamenco in Albuquerque.
Even though we present all of this very, very high-end flamenco, the rationale behind that is to inspire and cultivate young people.
Outreach is a huge part of their mission. Between Eva and her children, Joaquin and Marisol, they've taught thousands of flamenco students at the Institute and at UNM.
We all started as children, and we know the impact that flamenco had on us as young people.
To that end, the Institute sends teachers into New Mexico public schools.
And so we're going to clap along to the music. The music is in 4-4 time, which means that we count 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Sarah Ward, a Canadian who became enthralled with flamenco and now teaches it, is leading a class of fourth graders at the Taos Integrated School of the Arts. 15 kids stomped their sneakers to the count.
And then we had another rhythm. 2 and 3, 4. 2 and 3, 4. Yeah.
Ward says New Mexico is the best place to learn flamenco outside of Spain.
It has such a rich cultural heritage here. We have grown it in the earth here as well, and so it's very much part of the New Mexican experience.
One of the bright-eyed students is Cyprus Musialowski, 10 years old. The interviewer is journalist Monica Ortiz Uribe.
I feel an opportunity to let out anger. I really like stomping my feet, but I also feel like I can just flow and be me.
Yeah. What does it feel like when you're dancing and you release that anger?
It feels great. I love it. Because in class, I can't just stomp my feet around because I'll get in trouble.
Flamenco has been called performed aggression. The pounding wooden heels, the feral singing, the Baroque guitar work. The Spanish poet Federico Garcia Lorca defined duende, the spirit of flamenco, as tragedy-inspired ecstasy.
I think what really distinguishes flamenco is the grittiness of it.
Evelyn Mendoza is the 27-year-old education manager at the Flamenco Institute. While she has a degree in contemporary dance from UNM, it was flamenco that captured her soul.
I mean, you sweat your heart, soul, tears, blood, and everything into any dance form that you do. But flamenco is so different because it's fierce.
The fierceness, poetry, and passion of flamenco will be celebrated at Festival Flamenco Albuquerque, June 20 to 28. This year, 14 of the world's best flamenco companies will perform in Albuquerque at what's called the most celebrated flamenco festival outside of Spain. Naturally, it's in New Mexico. For NPR News, I'm John Burnett in Albuquerque.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in...
All Harlem's in a rage, and not from blowing gauge. They've got a new type menace up there. He just blew into town. He's slim and coffee brown. His trademark is the call that fills the air. But Harlemites don't take alarm. He really doesn't mean you harm. He's only loaded up with jungle charm. No trees about. But listen to him shout, whoa! He's the Tarzan of Harlem.
He's the Tarzan of Harlem.
Big gals and small, all answer to his call, whoa!